Hi, my name is Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. For the grace of God and the power of AA, I haven't had a drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. You've now seen my sport coat. Been warm. I fulfilled my responsibility to my sponsor and to our traditions of, you know, trying to look, you know, good when we're up here. Well, I congratulate the people who... it's really nice for me to see Walt up here. My sponsor just celebrated 44 years. And it's really... Everybody wants to hang out with the big kids. You know, I mean, when I was 6, I wanted to hang out with the people who were 12. And when I was 15, I wanted to, you know, hang out with the people who were 18 or 21 or, you know. And when I came in AA, the people who had a lot of sobriety were important to me. They were, you know, the big kids as far as I was concerned. And it's not much, it's kind of scary when you have, you know, 20 years of sobriety and you're the oldest sober person in a room. It doesn't feel right. And so I treasure the people who are still active and have long-term sobriety. It's important. And as our fellowship grows, I think it's important that we keep those, that the people keep themselves and that we encourage them to stay active. We're a village. We need our elders and we need, you know, our new people. And I hope that the three people who took the big book will be here next year celebrating 1 year of sobriety. And I don't think it's an accident that you're here, and I think that we all get opportunities, special moments, just little, you know, little particles of grace to come down that aren't, you know, that weren't there before, and we're here tonight, and, you know, take that energy and use it, and hang in there, and come back with a year of sobriety next year and stand up when they do that. I think we really need, if, along with Walt next year, that, the, you know, that you had those same books to pass on to three more people who stood up with the 1 day. There's a nice energy with the conference and with the people. I want to thank Eric for constantly trying to get a hold of me, which I'm kind of a moving target. I do not like people trying to control me, find out where I am. I want to do that. I want to thank Harlan and Kathy for taking us out to dinner Friday night and hosting us. Harlan was a Minnesotan. There's a number of people here, Jim and Chris, who are people that Linda and I sponsored earlier on, are here. Our state's kind of empty and your state's kind of growing. I don't know why that is. And but it's been nice for us. We have two of our three sons here, and Daniel has 70 days and Peter has 7 years, and our oldest boy, Bill, is in Japan tonight, but he just celebrated 11 years yesterday. And I've turned my wife into New York as a carrier, and I think there's enough evidence now that there's a problem, you know. And doesn't always feel good when you discover that you've got alcoholism or chemical dependency in your family, but it feels good when the solution becomes available. We've been a blessed family. Thank you, Pedro. And we've been blessed, you know, blessed with the disease and blessed with the recovery, so that's good. We had a nice dinner tonight. I love your dress. I think that's really cool. I think she's got it on backwards, but it's great material. So it's been a nice weekend. It's been nice for Linda and I to be here with the boys. Peter, our son, just moved to Los Angeles about 4 months ago, so we really haven't seen Pete since Christmas. So that's been nice. I'm going to talk a little bit about, and I've enjoyed the other speakers this weekend. I had to miss Walt this afternoon because it was so close to our dinner arrangements, and I missed the Allen on, but I've enjoyed everybody else and enjoyed the workshop that we had this morning. I took my first drink of alcohol when I was 14 years old. I was a freshman in high school. I was 4'11". I weighed 95 pounds. I was the second smallest kid in my high school class. As far back as I can remember, never liked who or what I was. I always wanted to be something different, bigger, better looking, wanted to be an athlete. I felt like everybody else got to school an hour early and held a meeting. And discussed what was going to go on for the day and who was going to do it, and I always missed the meeting. And it seemed like everybody else kind of knew. They just kind of, you know, it was a natural flow for them, and I was just like, I was always trying to catch up. And I'd say, you know, hell of a meeting. Wasn't it a great meeting? Hoping you'd talk about the meeting. But, you know, you didn't see me. Couldn't get you to talk about the meeting. And it really seemed like you knew stuff that I didn't know. And it seemed like, of course, I was looking at your outsides and my own insecurity, you know. So that's the way we all were to a certain extent. It just seemed harsher to me. And one night, a friend of mine had a fifth. We went out, we split that fifth, and my life changed. It was, God, when I put alcohol inside of me, I got a sense of ease and comfort that I had never experienced up until the time. I can remember that night. Was magic. It allowed me to move, you know, talk to girls, be funny, dance. I went to a military academy on a college campus. We drank in high school like most people drink in college. We had fraternities. Of 120 kids in my high school class, there are 12 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Of my five closest friends, four of us are in AA and one's in Al-Anon. I mean, we had a lot of alcoholism. Now, the good news is we had a lot of recovery. We had a lot of alcoholism. And I loved alcohol, loved what it did, drank a lot, got in a hell of a lot of trouble, got arrested a couple of times. By the time I finished high school, my drinking problem was a loud subject of conversation. And I come from a neat home, great mom and dad, seven kids, love, you know, nice brothers and sisters. We lived in a town, we lived in St. Paul, which is kind of the smaller of the Twin Cities, kind of the Fort Worth of the Dallas-Fort Worth, you know. And real Catholic. We lived with, you know, there were like clans. I mean, everybody had, you know, somewhere between 5 and 15 kids, you know. And it was just, you know, if you had less than 5, you had a lot of miscarriages. I mean, we just had, you know, there were just big families. You know, we had 7 and we were kind of an average. I mean, it was really a wonderful time. I was, and I still live in that town. I see people that I went to grade school with and high school with and, you know, all the time. So it's a big, small town, and really is, it's kind of a nice feel to do that. I went away to school, went away to the University of Notre Dame, thought my drinking had normalized. My drinking could not shut my drinking down. Don't know what the hell that was. You know, and school was important to me. I don't know, you know, but not as important as my drinking. And, you know, started out as a B student, ended up, you know, as barely a C student. And by the time I reached my senior year, I just drank my way out of the university. I just walked out. I was in civil engineering. It gets kind of tough to bluff your way through a thermodynamics exam. That's, you know, I was going to one school maybe a day a week. You know, by the time I was in my junior year, I, you know, kind of cribbed and crammed my way through college. I was good at physics and good at math, and somehow was able to hang in there as long as I did. I was due to be commissioned as an officer. I had to get a medical release. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. I thought that was nuts. I mean, I was just, you know, I was always in, you know, trouble. I almost got killed a couple of times in car accidents, and people thought I was, you know, had a serious drinking problem, but also maybe, I don't know if they thought I was suicidal, but self-destructive would be a good word. And, you know, seemingly a kid who was fairly well-equipped, but a catastrophe, you know, just not, you know, not able to, to get it on the road and make it work. And, you know, Notre Dame, I didn't want to walk out of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I remember AA kind of returns you to the scenes of your crime in an interesting way. About 20 years ago, I think I got invited back to Notre Dame to give an AA talk, and I went back there. And I hadn't been back since I walked out. And a buddy of mine came down. I had some amends I wanted to make, and I had a lot of old memories. And it was neat for me because it released me. It was, you know, it looked totally different. The buildings looked smaller. You know, I mean, when I was, I don't know what, you know, how it is when you go back to revisit something. I was in the middle of the talk, and you know how, you know, simple questions are difficult for alcoholics. You know, they're not simple for, you know, like, where did you go to school? Simple question, you know. Now, you ask an alcoholic that question, there's this pause. And it isn't that they won't answer it. They just don't want to know, you know, don't know how much time you have or how interested you are. Do you want to know the one I attended the longest or the, you know, I mean, it's a multiple. It's not a simple question. And, you know, are you married? And they get this, this kind of tortured look on their face, that, you know, and, you know, do you work? You know, I mean, it's not, I don't know why that is, but, you know, do you have any children? You know, I mean, you know, questions that, you know, normies could, you know, those are, you know, one-liners, and, you know, for, they're not. And so I used to get, that's where I went to school. I always felt bad, and I had to explain it, you know, because I finished at a different place, and I only went there a year, and it was, and I said, you know, I've always had a deep sense of failure about this place. I said, I just figured out why. I said, I think it's because I failed. It was kind of like a moment of clarity, you know, that just kind of came through. So if you're looking for deep insights tonight, you might want to take a potty break. But I left. I came home. I finished school at a local university. When I finished school at St. Thomas University, my dad asked me to leave home. He said, we love you and we care about you, but you're a pain in the ass. And he said, you don't follow the rules. And he said, it's just not working, you know, and it's time that you left. And I left home, and I took a job at a liquor store, and I was a delivery guy, and it was bad. I almost killed a little girl with that delivery truck drunk one morning. It was a long story, which I won't bore you with. She was not hurt, but I came within inches of doing that, lost the job for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck. Took a job as a waiter at a private club in Minneapolis. I'm living, not on Skid Row, but I have an apartment in St. Paul that I'm sharing with the guy that I, in the 6 months I was a waiter, I think I only made it home a couple of nights. But I was living in kind of flop houses in Minneapolis, and I'm, you know, getting up in the morning, drinking a couple of beers, going to work, having a Dexedrine. I work from 10 to 2 as a waiter, and it's from 2 to 5 I go drink beer, and at 5 I go buy a pint, half pint, fifth, you know, keep it in my locker. And somewhere during the day I'd find where I was going to live, you know. You know, Dr. Seuss, that child author, those are actual photographs of people I live with during that period of time in my life. And one night I went to a party and I got my face kicked in. I got fired as a waiter and I was tapped. She had no place to go. And I went home and I asked my parents if I could move back in the house. And they said, yeah, if I wouldn't drink, I could move back in. And I moved back in. Alcoholism meant a lot of different things to me. Maybe what it meant more than anything else is about every 6 months I started my life over. I was always starting over. I mean, I never, you know, I looked like I was just hell-bent to tear my life apart and to destroy our family's values, property, you know, prestige, all those things. I just looked like I wanted to kind of sully everything around me. And it wasn't true. I think if you go to put my old man in one room and me in another and asked each of us the question about what do you want for Bob, I think what my father wanted for me was much what I wanted for me. That you know, would have surprised my father, I'll tell you. But it was true. I just didn't know how to get it. I wanted to be accomplished, and I wanted to finish school, and I wanted to maybe go to graduate school and do different things. I just could not shut my drinking down. But I made the largest full court press of trying to change my life when I moved back in the house. I thought, God, if I could just, you know. So I got back together with Linda, who today is my lovely wife, and we became engaged and married. Linda's a very active member of Al-Anon, been in Al-Anon 30 years. I have been a constant source of growth for Linda. Stand up, Linda. Come on. She wasn't much when I got her, but she's over the years. But you know, there's just, you know, as hard as you work, there's just always communication. I've gained a little weight, and I've gotten kind of out of shape the last couple of years, and I've been trying to, you know. So we were discussing that maybe I should get a bike, you know, and get back in shape. I bought a bike. Now I bought a Harley. And I don't know. I mean, I tried to, you know, you try to do those things for her, and I don't, you know. Try as you may, you know, I just can't figure that out. So I got back together with Linda, bought my first automobile, got a job as an executive trainee with a manufacturing concern. I thought, well, you know. Wow, it's really going to happen. I'm going to become an adult. Thought if I could just kind of make it to 30, you know, I'd be okay. And only, God, it didn't happen. I was a class drunk at Notre Dame. I had 5 guys petition to have me removed from the engineering school at Notre Dame. I mean, I literally was the class drunk. Now I'm in an engineering company. I am the company drunk. I mean, I am, you know, I used up my sick leave the first 2 weeks. I'm falling asleep in the falling asleep in the John, you know, and I'm stumbling down the hall with my legs asleep. I mean, I'm just this, you know, I'm falling asleep at my desk. It's just, you know, I could not shut it down. This is not good. I know it's not working. And, you know, God, I'm just, you know, I'm just falling apart, and I've got all this big audience all around me. You know, work was not, you know, my thing in those days. And I don't know. I left that job, you know, I took a sales job, thought I needed more freedom, flexibility. And I had that job, I guess, for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, and I went out on a, about a 3 or 4 day drunk. One of my buddies got married. Weddings were always good for about a week. And I woke up Thursday afternoon, August 1967, and hungover. Been drinking for 4 days, bad shape. And all of a sudden, the recommendation, I didn't know if I had a job, a fiancé, or a place to live, and all of a sudden, the recommendation of my psychiatrist and my father that I call Alcoholics Anonymous didn't seem so impossible, and I called AA. And I got an old-timer down central office. He talked to me. And he asked me if I could go meet two guys at a cafe in about an hour. And I said, yes, I could. And he described them to me and told me where to go at the cafe. And I got off the phone and called work and found out I had a job, and called Linda and found out I was still engaged, and called home and found out they were concerned rather than mad. And I thought, why the hell did you call AA? I thought, you know, it's kind of a... kind of an overreaction, you know. I mean, this is, it was kind of the first example of God working in my life. I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like, so I went to go meet these two guys. When you're young and in trouble, you get exposed to a lot of helpers. You get exposed, in my case, to priests and nuns and bishops and, you know, deans, lawyers, doctors, judges. Psychologists, psychiatrists, MDs. I had been in a lot of family conferences, a lot of conferences where they're talking about you but not to you. You are the subject. You are there, but you are not participating. And I thought when I went to meet these two guys that this would be similar, that they'd be, you know, I was 23, and I, you know, they'd be older guys, and they'd ask me a bunch of questions about myself, and then they'd maybe give me a test, and, you know, what to do. And, of course, that wasn't what I found. I went and I met one guy had 6 months, one guy had 6 years. The guy with 6 years just celebrated 36 years this last Saturday with my sponsor who had 44 years. And they sat me down and they said, we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. One guy's name was Bobby, the other guy's name was Warren. They said, we had a drinking problem and we found an answer for our problem. And one of the things we do is try to share that answer with someone else, and that seemed to help us stay sober. So we're here as much for ourselves as we are. You know, they weren't getting a toaster for signing me up. It wasn't a multi-level, you know, marketing deal. It was just, they were just there, you know, they were there doing a 12-step call, and they told me their stories. And that night, my life changed. We have many traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the greatest of which is that we share our experience, strength, and hope, and not our thinking, not our ideology, not our concepts. Those two men shared their life with me, and my life changed. Such, I believe, I think there's a mystical quality to communication. I really think that those two men, something magical happened in that conversation. They asked me if I wanted to go to my, you know, it was the first time I'd ever talked to another person on a drinking problem. You know, I talked to lots of experts, but I'd never, ever talked to another person who had my, you know, we were laughing about stuff that I would not tell anybody. You know, and they were very free about sharing it, and it was a little embarrassing. You know, it was interesting. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and over the period of the next number of months, I was able to make two discoveries that were to change my life. I drank twice after walking in AA, once on a business trip when I had almost a month, and I went on a trip to the West Coast, did not go to AA, like I was told. I was told to call the moment I got in, and I didn't. I told everybody I had a bet, and I stayed sober 1 week and drank the second week and got in a bunch of trouble. Then I stayed sober almost 3 months, and Linda and I were married, and we honeymooned, and I got drunk on our honeymoon, which I think I planned surreptitiously. I did not, I was always, you know, don't think I quite let me know I was going to do it, although I was making lots of preparations for it. You know where the divers dive off those cliffs? And I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. And I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. But I could do that, you know. Went over and introduced myself to the ex-president of Mexico. His nephew had been my roommate at Notre Dame. He was not impressed. His bodyguards were not impressed. I was just blind drunk. I dove off the public landing, climbed up the cliff, split my swimsuit, cut my leg. Linda's going absolutely nuts. I got up about 85 or 90 feet. I got stuck. You know, you couldn't get up, couldn't get down. And, you know, I'm watching the waves come in and go out, and I'm trying to decide whether to jump or dive. You know, not sure whether I want to jump or dive. And finally figured, ah, screw it, and I dove. God watches after fools and drunks, because I made it. And, you know, Norm Alpe used to talk about seconds and inches. If I would have jumped, I would have died. End of story. You can't get out. You have to get out almost 30 feet, you know, to get out in the center of the channel. If I would have jumped, I would have died. I didn't know that. I was just, you know, dive, jump. You know, 10 years later, my wife and I were celebrating our 10th wedding anniversary, and she gave me a little picture of that chasm. And we were standing on the balcony at the El Mirador Hotel at La Quebrada looking at the divers dive at midnight. And I said, God, that's the dumbest thing I ever did. And she said, honey, it's not even in the top 10. So, I don't know how people can share a life and look at it so differently, but it's, but I had my last drink in the airplane on the way home, December the 10th, 1967. I came to AA, I was 23 years old, I was confused, everybody was telling me they thought I had a drinking problem, I didn't think I had a drinking problem, I thought drinking was my answer, not my problem. I thought drinking caused me some difficulty, but by and large I found nothing. I don't know why I walked through, I had like a noise in my head, I had like my amplifier was up at 9. I can't tell you why, I don't, you know, it seemed to me that I've been blessed in lots of ways, you know, and but I've never felt okay about me, and I've never felt okay about it. I never felt like I was okay. I never felt like it was okay. I don't have an answer for that today. I don't know why I had that angst inside of me. I don't know why that I felt better with a half pint or a pint inside of me, that I felt normal. It took my amplifier from 9 down to 3. It let me hear the things that were going on, and it made me part of what was going on in the room. When I didn't have that, I was so self-involved. So insecure in many ways that I just could not freely participate in what was going on. And so I thought alcohol was my answer. But you told me that alcoholism was a disease, physical, mental, and spiritual. And once I crossed the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, my alcoholism affected me all the time, when I was drinking and when I was not drinking. Wow. I mean, I remember, you know, you guys, I mean, someone, my sponsor told me that alcoholism was, the physical part was 10% of the deal. It blew my mind. It still blows my mind. You know, I thought we'd spend a lot of time in AA talking about how not to drink. I mean, I literally thought, you know, we'd have meeting, oh, where are you going next week? How are you going to handle this? You know, what are you going to... And there's almost not much discussion about that. You know, if you're new and you are going back to a family reunion or something like that, we'll talk about how to handle some of that stuff. But mostly it's talk about how to live. And what they said to me, you know, is you've got, if all you have is a drinking problem, all you have to do is quit. He said, have you ever tried to quit? I said, yeah, I quit. He said, did it work? I said, no, it didn't work. He said, I didn't think so. What's wrong with you is alcoholism. The symptom of alcoholism is a drinking problem, but alcoholism is spiritual and mental as well as physical. And what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is once we take our last drink of alcohol is we use the 12 steps of the recovery program of AA to find a different way to live. A different way to live that's efficiently better than the way we lived before, so that we don't have to go back to booze or drugs to do something for us that we were unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. And if you don't change, if you don't find a better way to live, you're going to go back if you don't know how to live without it. Boy, I tell you, I don't know if I ever heard a truer thing than that those men told me that night in AA. The other discovery I made is there was an awful lot of people who had drunk an awful lot of booze and taken a lot of dope, and now they weren't doing it. And the reason they weren't doing it is they like what they found in sobriety better than what they found in a bottle. That confused me. I thought, boy, I might have to quit, but my life's sober. I mean, I thought, you know, long, dull. I didn't like people who didn't drink, didn't want to be around them. But listen to your stories. You're out there chasing it real good. It got too tough. Something happened to you, and you were able to stop, and your lives weren't over. There was a zest, a vitality, an energy, and a humor in you that I have been attracted to since I walked in the front doors of AA and has by the grace of God, allowed me to stay and find my answer in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had my last drink a week after my 24th birthday. I'm 24 years old. I was a kid who was always kind of an underachiever, supposed to be, you know, lots of potential, as we've all heard that word, those of us, you know, through most of our lives. Everybody able to, but I thought, hey, baby, this is it. You know, now I got it. I got, you know, I got the problem. You've got the answer. I mean, what could be better? I mean, the reason that I've never been able to fulfill my potential is I've been an alcoholic. Now I know I'm an alcoholic. Now I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now that I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I do what the program says, I won't have any more problems. And, so I thought, I've got five or six other things that are going on in my life, you know, and if you've got the answer and I got the problem, you maybe won't make them go away. And hell, it might take a year. Well, my problems did not go away in a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, have not totally gone away in 30 years. But, you know, my problems were horrible but ordinary. I couldn't get up in the morning. It's not a big deal. I was supposed to be at work at 8. I set the alarm clock for about 6:45. I get up about 7:45. It's hard to be at work at 8 if you get up at 7:45. Now, an alcoholic can do it, but it's hard on them. We're quick. We're quick. But it's tough. And then when I got to work, I was never sure quite what to do there. So I left a lot. And then I go on these two-hour AA lunches or three-hour. Anytime, anywhere, the hand of AA reaches out, I wanted to be there, of course. Because I was responsible, I think. I had some money problems. I spent $300 more a month than I made. If you do that over a long period of time, you'll end up in debt. I just want to report that to you in case you're running that one and you don't know where it goes. And then we had some marital issues. Linda and I, Linda, you know, was his only child. Her father was this great guy. Came home every night at 5:00. I was not quite that regular. So we both came to the marriage with expectations about everything from, I don't know, how to communicate, you know. And she's a nurse. She was an RN. She was, you know, we were seeing less of each other married than when we were dating. I mean, we were, because, you know, she'd get up at 6 to go to work. I'd be in bed. I'd come home, usually sometimes around 5, and she'd broil something. All she could do is broil. So whatever we could broil, she'd broil. And she since has become a wonderful cook, but in those days she could only broil. So we'd broil something and I'd go to the meeting. And when I came home from the meeting, it was, you know, I didn't want to miss anything, so it was 11:00, 11:30, you know. She's in bed. And I'm going to 5, 6, 7 meetings a week. So she's seeing less of me. She's going to Al-Anon, and then she starts these real negative questions, like, isn't one of the things you're supposed to do is practice the principles in our home? I thought, that's none of your business. I mean, I don't know why I don't think, you know. I mean, that's kind of personal. I mean, you know, you have your program. I have my program. You know, that's... And then we started to have kids. I had great mom and dad, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes my parents did, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made and a bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent with my kids. I am not proud of that, but that's an accurate description of how I was. And I had a gambling problem. It was more like a hobby. 3 or 4 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It was kind of like, it was just, you know, but I was making 5 or 10 grand a year playing backgammon, and it kind of felt like a second job, you know. These were not annual problems or quarterly problems or monthly problems. They were daily problems. I had every one of these problems in my first year of sobriety and never noticed them. I was like on a honeymoon. I was so in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so enthusiastic. It was like coming home. It was like, it literally was. I mean, it was like, you know, I just wanted to just immerse myself in AA. I wanted to know the language and the words and the steps and the program. And I hung out. I hung out with the old timers and I just wanted everything about it. about towards the end of my first year, I started to get in touch one by one with my defects of character and the unworkability of my life. And one by one, these issues, I'm glad they weren't handed to me all at once, but they'd come and I'd take them on. And by my second year, I think by the end of my second year, I had a pretty good list. You know, I did a fifth step during my first year, but my inventory was not very insightful. My inventory was mostly getting rid of the things that made me a moral leper, that separated me from you and really made me feel quite guilty. And even though I thought they were the most dramatic, important things in my life, they turned out to be not very important to me. Some of the most disgusting things that I did in my life didn't have much meaning with respect to my life. They were random events. But the dailiness and the ongoingness and the root of many of my issues that remained after I got sober were more important to me, and I didn't have much insight about them in my first year of sobriety. By my second year now, I've got a list, and I'm starting to find out about what AA has to do with Wednesday, and I'm bumping along. And by my second year, you know, I got the list. My third year, they're starting to bother me. My fourth and fifth year, they're eating my lunch. And by my seventh year, I'm having a tough time. I'm a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a guy who really wanted to live life well. It's important to me how I live. The principles are important to me. My integrity is important to me. I wanted to live on the inside like I was talking on the outside, and it was important to me, and I wasn't able to do it. I had, you know, God, I'd be 7 years sober, and a new guy would come in with a bushel basket full of manure that everybody does and tell me about all the problems, and I'd say, hey, as bad as it is and as hopeless as it seems, God, you're in the right place. I'm really glad you're here tonight. Sit down, get a cup of coffee. And I know you don't know this, but if you just stay, and I'll say that to the people tonight that took those big books, if you just stay, try to practice the steps. Get a sponsor. Read the book. Just try to incorporate. You don't have to do it perfectly. You just have to stay and don't drink. Keep the body here. You will, you know, it takes time to heal. See that guy over there? God, his life was just a mess 2 years ago, and now he's just knocking it out of the park. You know, so hang in there and glad you're here. And then I get in the car and I'd say, when's it going to work for you, Bob? You know, you're 7 years sober. When's it going to work for you? You just bought a sport coat today for $300 at a store where you had a $400 bill. When are you going to stop doing that? When are you going to stop buying things you don't need, you know, with money you don't have to impress people you don't like? I mean, when are you going to, you know... Another cup of coffee. When are you going to learn how to work? You know, I mean, I don't think you have a pass. Almost everybody knows how to work. When are you going to learn how to work? When are you going to be nicer to your children and more loving with your wife? When are you going to quit gambling? And I didn't have an answer because I had been trying as hard as I knew how to try to change each of those things and failing regularly. I thought, you know, you get me sober and I'll learn how to be a husband. You get me sober and I'll work. You get me, you know, you heal my alcoholism. I don't know why I thought that. I mean, I don't know, no one taught me that as I look back on it, but that internally I kind of separated my life. And I thought, you get me well from alcoholism, and I thought I should know, intuitively know. I had good models. I mean, everybody knows how to work. Everybody knows how to, you know, be a husband. Everybody knows how to be a... Well, I did not seem to know, or I wasn't able to perform. If I knew how to do it, I wasn't able to do it. Did not have the power to do it. And, you know, I got a problem. The problem, you know, the two things that have saved my fanny in Alcoholics Anonymous are, number one, I've never been able to keep my mouth shut, which is good because I didn't have as many secrets as some people who I sponsor do. I was in communication. You know, I would tell my sponsor about 75% of what was going on. Now, I know you're supposed to tell your sponsor 100% of what's going on, but 75 was what I did. And I really think that, you know, people who say, I tell my sponsor everything, I say, oh, baloney. They almost don't make anybody like that. You know, I do everything I'm told. Give me a break. You know, I mean, I got these guys that call me in the morning and they say, you know, gee, do you think I should wear gray socks or blue socks today? And I'm saying, well, Dave, I don't know. Let's go with the gray. And then you get together with them later, and oh, by the way, I got married on Tuesday. And I, you know, so it is, you know, it's kind of a, you know. And then later in the week, you hear Dave talk about how close he is, and he just, you know, I just came in here and did everything I was told, and it's just everything's going well. And And the other thing that saved me is my love, I believe, for the old-timers and my sponsor. I was close to my sponsor. And But I was doing the best I knew how to communicate to Warren what was going on, but I was scared. I didn't know how scared I was. I did not know that. I talked to Warren as much as I could and told him as much as I could tell him. I knew what the answer was. The answer was to have a better, stronger relationship with God. By the time I'm 7 years sober, I know that answer. But there's a problem. Go knock on the door. God says, "Who's there?" I say, "Bob is God," or "God is Bob." And that's the problem. No. And God says, "What do you want?" And I say, "Well, I'm 7 years sober. My ass is falling off." I said, "I feel like I'm on the down escalator going up." I said, I'm working as hard as I know how to work. I'm going to 5 meetings a week. I'm active. I'm talking in AA. I'm active in service and sponsoring people. And my life's going backwards. I'm in as much debt as I was when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm having trouble at work. Linda's not very pleased with what's going on. I just got the list. And I said, seems like people who have a better life have a better relationship with you, and I want to sign up. And God's going to say, "Fine." I'm saying, "What do I do?" And God's going to say, "Well, quit gambling. Get up in the morning, go to work, stay to work. Do not spend more money than you make. Be kind and loving to your wife and be gentle with your children." I'm going to say, "God, if I knew how to do all those things, I wouldn't need God." You know, I mean, what, you know, what's the use of going to God to ask to develop a relationship if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? Now, I know what God wants me to do. I just can't do it. My idea was, as soon as I clean my act up, I'll go to God. You know, as soon as I really can quit gambling, as soon as I really can quit doing the things I'm doing that don't work, I'll go to God. But until I can do that, what's the use? And I was stuck in that place for almost 2 years. And finally, at about 7 years, I mean, I really was in tough shape. You know, you're at the point where you're almost going to commit suicide or talk to your sponsor. You know, you're just literally, you know, right on, I mean, not a joke, you know, not a joke. And I went back to the steps with a ferocity that I hadn't been at them for a while. And I took step one. I was 8 years sober, and I found out what powerlessness and unmanageability meant to me, and it wasn't very hard. I was clearly powerless, and my life was unmanageable. You know what fooled me was step two. I thought, you know, could have put my hand on a lie detector. "Do you believe God's going to restore us to sanity?" "Yes." Needle would not have moved. If you would have asked me at 8 years of sobriety, "Do I believe God's going to restore Bob Bazan's sanity?" The answer is no. I lost that belief. I'm 8 years sober, busted my britches, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, doing everything I know how to do, and my behind's falling off. I no longer believe that God's going to restore me to sanity. I don't know. I must be different. I don't know if I'm supposed to go to Gamblers Anonymous or Spenders Anonymous or something. I mean, if I would have gone to a meeting for every problem I had, I would have been a busy kid. And but, you know, clearly my life's out of sync. I know the words. I know what to do. I just can't. I feel like I'm dying. I feel like I'm lying down next to a lake dying of thirst. Like there's a plastic wall between me and the lake, and I cannot drink. I took step three with my sponsor on my knees in his office. I had not done that before, but I didn't want to miss anything. It was a little bit embarrassing, but I thought, what the heck, I'm going to. Don't want to, you know, this time I'm going to dot the I's and cross the T's. I did a four-step when I went to it, and this is not, I didn't do it with Warren. I did it with a different, I asked a man temporarily to be my sponsor for about a five-year period of time in there. And I went and I took my fifth step with him, and I said, "Be careful, because when you're done with the fifth step, I'm going to do whatever you tell me to do." I said, "I'm in more pain than I've ever been in my life, and I think it's unnecessary that I'm in this level of pain." And I took my fifth step with him, and we talked and cried a little bit. When I was done, one of the things he wanted me to do was go to an industrial psychologist. And I did not want to do it. Felt like a failure. Felt like an admission of failure of my AA program. I felt like, you know, but I promised him I would, so I did. And I went to the psychologist, and he said, I had a lot of issues about my dad. My father was my hero. He was bigger than life. He was a little bit intimidating to me. But he was one of those Second World War guys that came back and, you know, worked hard, played hard, had big families, you know, was successful and worked in the community, you know, and made life look easy. And it seemed like I was never going to be quite as good as my old man. And so I went there, and the psychologist said, can you get your parents involved? And I said, no. I said, my parents have been involved with me all their life. I said, you know, they're now in their late 60s, And if you can't help me without getting my mother and father involved, please refer me to someone who can. He said, well, you get your wife involved. I thought, well, you know, when you get your wife involved, you have a different data bank. You know, it's a... You know, you answer questions differently, and everybody sees things differently. But I said, yeah, I'll get Linda involved. He said, well, you get the kids involved. And I said, well, they're pretty young, but I thought, okay. So I started working with a psychologist. I made a discovery in the process that was, I think, critical to my long-term serenity. And I remember, you know, he asked me, he said, why are you so afraid of failure? And I really wanted to punch him in the nose. I said, listen, you ass. I said, you're a doctor. I said, you fail. You know, you just take your little sign, you walk down the hall, you put it on a different door, and you're making $100,000 again. And I said, I'm about to go broke. I wonder why. I'm working 2 hours a day, and it's just not working. I don't know why, you know, it's a mystery. The business is failing, and I'm playing backgammon, doing pretty well playing backgammon. And I said, I'm about to go under my business, and when I fail, I'm going to lose everything I had. I'm going to put my name in the paper, and I'm going to go down. And I, you know, small community, I'm going to lose everything I have. And he looked over at my wife, and he said, Linda, if Bob loses everything he have, will he lose you? And Linda said, nope, wouldn't lose me. He looked over at Billy and Peter, and he said, if your dad lost everything he had, would he lose you? And the boy said, oh, hell no. You know, if you can't lose, you can't play. I was a guy who was on the football team. I had a uniform. I did all the calisthenics. I did all the stuff in the locker room. I ran all the laps. But when they blew the whistle to block and tackle, I went up in the stands because I don't block and tackle. I don't. I'm the guy who, if we were going to have a running race, I'd talk and sound like I was a great runner. I have a great pair of tennis shoes and a good pair of shorts and expensive shirt. And I tell you that I won some race in Minnesota, and you'd expect when we went off on that race that I'd, you know, should be in the top 10. And for the first, when the gun would sound for about the first quarter of the race, I'd be in the top 10. And then somewhere between halfway and three quarters of the way through the race, I'd fall down and hurt myself. When the race is over, someone would say, what happened to that guy from Minnesota? I said, I don't know, must have pulled a hamstring. He was up in the top 10 for a while. He's a pretty good runner, won some race in Minnesota. Yeah, it's really too bad. But if you would have known me better, if you would have followed me around in a helicopter for a year or two before I came to the race in Arizona, you would have known within 50 feet when I would have fallen down. Because I don't finish anything. And I'll tell you, it gets old. It gets real old. Not too long after I was in the room, and it was a deeply profound, important discovery to know how pervasive fear was. When I took my inventories earlier, I had done 3 inventories prior to the one that I did that period of time with my sponsor. I did them with clergy. Fear was not particularly a dominant theme of my 4th and 5th step. I did not have the insight. I was either so damn afraid that I could not even identify it for myself, that I had no idea the depth of which it was happening to me. And it was profound. I believe that it is, as Bill talked about, you know, a thread that goes to every aspect of our lives. Not too long after I did that 5th step and went to the psychologist, I had one of the worst days I had in AA. I got up late, went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game. I won about $600, missed dinner, missed the AA meeting, came home, got in a fight with my wife, and slapped one of the kids. It was one of those days you would have liked to have had it videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do for you. One of those days, you know, we worry that your sponsor would all of a sudden walk on the door and see how life really was. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, what do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there? It's your life. And I said, yeah, I was there. But it's so habitual. It's almost like I go into a blackout. I mean, it's so habitual I don't even have to think about what... And all of a sudden I realized, I just stopped. And I realized what a bunch of hooey that was. That my life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was. I sounded like a guy who wanted to quit gambling. If you wanted to know if I wanted to quit gambling, you could have talked to my wife or my business partner. I wanted to gamble whenever I wanted to gamble for as much money as I wanted to gamble and not have problems because of gambling. I sounded like a guy who wanted his finances in order. I wanted money without work. I wanted my wife's and children's affection and care without spending time with them. And all of a sudden I realized that my life was the way it was because I designed it the way it was, and I got afraid of staying that way. I got afraid of either drinking or becoming a sober ass. And that night I got down on my knees and I realized that I had tried as hard as I knew how to try to clean up my act, and I had failed, and I was given the opportunity to take the sixth and the seventh step of the program of AA. The sixth step said that we were entirely ready to have God and remove our defects of character. And the seventh step said that we humbly ask and remove our shortcomings. I had spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I do not have the power to get rid of them. It happens through me. I participate, but I am not the source. I am the pipe. I am not the well. It happens through me, not by me. A doctor does not heal. He creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer does not grow. He plants a seed, creates a fertile environment, plants a seed, and creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place, and God grows, and we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes us. It's an atmosphere, I believe, of the attitudes of the sixth and the seventh step and the three requirements to being honest, open-minded, and being willing. That night, out of fear, I got down on my knees. I took the sixth and the seventh step, and five of the major problems in my life disappeared that night. Such, I believe, is the power of God, and such, I believe, is the power of the program. It is not just not to drink. It is to learn how to live fully and rich, and to have some peace in your life. Now, I want to tell you, if you're really serious about making a change, I'm a guy who, when I go on a diet, I usually buy a quart of ice cream and a bag of cookies. It's the last day I'm going to eat. It's already been a bad day. I'm just going to finish it off. I probably will never have ice cream again. I'm just going to have just a little bit of ice, you know, so that I wouldn't feel bad, you know, later on when I've never had it again. And if you understand that kind of thinking, you've made a lot of promises to yourself and you've not been able to keep them. There's something that when you really are serious about making a change, you put supports in. And I made appointments with my sponsor and my psychologist about when I'd go to work and when I'd leave work. I turned the finances over to my wife. My wife did not have the issues with money. She had this new technique. She could pay a third of a bill. Damnedest thing I had ever heard of. And she had us out of financial trouble in a relatively short period of time. I quit gambling that day. I started dating my wife 23 years ago or 24 years ago. I've dated my wife every Friday night for the last 23 years. So we have one night a week that we have each other's undivided attention. If we're not home Friday night, it's another night. I had her love and affection. With everybody else's love and affection, I had to learn how to go back and be with my wife and to be romantic. We were always talking about kids or money or business. It just got so we were not with each other in the way that we learned how to love and become attracted to each other. So, I mean, when I sponsor these young guys, I try to, you know, go treat your wife like you treat your mistress if you lost your wife. You know, go shack up, get on an airplane, go to Chicago, put some spice back in your life. Put some, you know, start doing some things that are enjoyable for each other. And it's a real live dangerous date. No one goes out on that, you know, we go out alone. And I had to actually learn how to be, again, alone and enjoy being with my wife. I spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours learning how to be a better parent. I think being a parent takes 125% of whatever you got. I think it's one of the biggest, most profound tasks and joyful opportunities that there is in life, but it's big. I mean, it will show up every flaw that you have, but I think it's one of the great opportunities. One of the things I'm so grateful, I look at my sons in the front row, and they have alcoholism. What if I was such an asshole that my kids would not have joined AA because of how I was in sobriety? But I gave a great talk. I was a hell of a guy. Attended lots of meetings. Sponsored a hell of a lot of people. Wouldn't that have been a wonderful thing? Not good. The measure of what it is to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous is not what you do behind a podium. It is not what you do in a meeting. It is not just how many people you sponsor. It is maybe ask your wife, maybe ask your neighbor, maybe ask someone else about how AA has improved your life. In those years after I took the sixth and the seventh step and the fourth and fifth and made those changes, my life took off like it was on a rocket ship. For 10 years, everything I touched turned to gold. The guy who didn't know how to work was able to work, and I made enough money to burn a wet elephant. It was a period of time. And, you know, there are problems with failures, but there are problems with success. And I developed an invisible arrogance. You know, I thought God was blessing me because of what a wonderful guy I was. You know, and how would you like to be around that attitude, you know? And, you know, bought the big house, 2 Mercedes, you know, just whatever we wanted, we got. And those, I became deeply shallow during that period of time. But I have a gift for it, and I think you gotta go. I think you have to go with what you have. And so, 1986, they passed the Tax Act, and I was in the real estate investment business, and things came to a screeching halt. And by 1990-1991, I was staring bankruptcy in the face. I had lost $8 million in 3 years, and I was back again facing. It just seemed impossible to me. It was Peter had been going to school in Colorado his freshman year, and he came home at Christmas, and he got drunk, and he totaled out an automobile, and he got arrested and went to detox. It was his Christmas present to his mother and I. And he was in treatment, and I'm going broke. And we'd go, Linda and I, Friday nights, we'd go over to the halfway house where he was, and we'd sit down for the meeting. I'd start crying when the meeting started. I just ached from every pore in my body. You know, I can just imagine now what people say, you know, see that guy over there? Guy's got 23 years. How'd you like to have, you know, that, how'd you like to have what he has? You know that? I think he's got the clap. I've never seen anything like that. I don't know what. But I think when you're in trouble and you're hurt, you either get more active or less active, and I got more active, and I guess I had to find out who I was without my money. And I just before I went through this process, I asked a man to be my spiritual director, and I went to him, and he said, "What do you want?" I was 22 years sober, and I said, "Well," I said, "you know, I said, I'm pretty successful. Things are going pretty good." I said, "The two things I'd like to do, I'd like to be more loving and less materialistic." And within about 3 weeks, I started to lose everything I had. And I went back to George. I called him up. I said, "George, we've got to talk." I said, "I wasn't explicit enough when I told you that I wanted to be less material. I said, I wanted to keep the things and be less materialistic." But we had to sell the big house, and we had to get rid of the Mercedes, and we had to do lots of things. And I think that's how loud, you know, I think life is a school. I think life will present us with the opportunities that will request, the universe will request of us to change the things in our lives that don't work. The universe will request of us to learn the things that we need to learn to put our lives in balance. I think that those are the opportunities that happen in marriage. I think those are the opportunities that happen in parenting. I think those are some of the opportunities that happen in work and community. I think there are changes that we are flawed people. Bad, you know, alcoholics are, you know, in many cases badly flawed, and we really need to put these principles in action in our lives, and there's a lot of changes and corrections that we have to make in order to live happier and productive lives. And most of us don't want, you know, I guess... So life has been an adventure for me. I have literally lived almost my entire adult life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm 55 years old. I'm, you know, 30 plus years sober. I'm married 30 years. We just celebrated 30 years of marriage. I've got, you know, 3 kids, 29, 27, and 18. I guess we've got 3 kids. I always say I have 3 kids, and she corrects me later. Okay. We've got 3 kids. And I've had to learn how to be a parent. I've had to learn how to be a father. I've had to learn how to be a man. I've had to learn how to run a business. I've had to learn how to live in Alcoholics Anonymous. The adventure has been ever so much different than I would have anticipated it to be. I thought all I'd have to come to AA and quit drinking and, you know, somehow I just get on from there and have a normal life, and it hasn't seemed to be. I thought recovery was the absence of problems. I don't know where I got that idea, but if you asked me to define recovery, I would have said it was the absence of problems. That's just nuts. But I mean, I thought that if you were a good Christian, you did not sin. That being a good religious person was the absence of sin. I really thought that, you know, and I so admired many of the older members of Alcoholics Anonymous, I either forgave them their flaws or imperfections, or I didn't think they had any, which was also nuts because I'm in meetings with them, listening to them, but I was so focused on my own flaws and I somehow forgave them, and I had, you know, a different kind of arrogance that I would not forgive me or have the balance that I would do that. You know, I guess one of the things, I remember one of my mentors in AA, a guy by the name of Bob White from Texas, he was just this wonderful guy, and he said, you know, when he asked me, we were talking one time, and he said, you'll find out when you get over 25 years of sobriety or over 30 years, he said, you get on themes, you get ideas that kind of captivate you, you get things that you're interested in, otherwise you just couldn't keep doing this. You know, this is, you know, just giving your talk, you know, can get a little bit boring. It doesn't really get boring for me because there's something, you are my people, you are my family. There is something integral about, and I try not to do it so often that I get, that it becomes, that it stays alive for me, you know, that I do that. And one of my themes is about change. I know what it is to sit in an audience like this and listen to people. I have, and to have your life not working and to have almost a despair about not being able to change some of the things you'd really like to change and that you'd really thought when you came into AA you'd be able to put your hands on the dials and knobs and dial it in and get it changed. And one of the great things is I've been reading, is the thought, I think if I asked everybody to raise their hand who would want to change the things in their lives that don't work, to get rid of the unworkability in your life, that almost all of us would raise our hands and say, you know, I want to get rid of the unworkability. And I want to tell you something. What I've learned is we don't want to change. And I've known that at some level, but I've known it at a deeper level than I've ever known it before. Some of the guys I sponsor, you know, the fourth step in the big book's kind of complicated. You know, it's got all those columns and lines and stuff, you know. So I got a new thing that I do with the guys, and I say, you know, let's pretend that I'm sponsoring a guy who's 35 years old, married with kids. And I say, okay, you're having a little trouble with the fourth step. I said, I got a suggestion. I said, get your wife and your mom and dad and your kids and your neighbor and your brothers and sisters and your boss and a coworker and a couple of your AA peers and two creditors and bring them over to the house. And I said, then make a pot of coffee and hand out tablets and pencils and say that we have this step in AA where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I'm having trouble doing that, and I was wondering if you would help. Do you know why we laugh at that? Is we wouldn't call the meeting. Do you know why we wouldn't call the meeting? We don't want to change. I'll tell you, it's worse than that, baby. We don't even want to know. We do not even want to know. We train each other about what we can talk about and what we can't talk about. We train our wives. We're not going to talk about that. Nod your head up and down if you understand we're not talking about that. Okay? If you want to talk about that, it's going to be expensive. If you want to talk, we are not talking about, you train your kids about what they can talk about and what they can't talk about. There's an elephant in the living room. Everybody smells peanuts and hay, but no one can talk about the elephant. You know, I don't know what it is in AA. You can try and fail and try and fail and try and fail in your early sobriety, and for some reason you're still able to grow. But there comes a time where you get to know enough, and it comes a time to change. And when you get to that time, you need to change, or if you don't change, you will build an addition onto your house to accommodate the crap. And the girl chasers will hang out with the girl chasers, the gamblers hang out with the gamblers, and the overspenders hang out, and we got a deal. I won't call you on your crap, you don't call me on mine. Deal? We'll talk about the steps, we'll talk about the traditions, we'll talk about meetings, but you don't call me on my crap, and I won't call you on mine. Not a very powerful deal, but a deal that nonetheless is made all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got a deal with friends of mine, and the deal is call me on my crap. When you see something in my life that is not working, if you see me out of line, tell me that I am out of line. Now that is, it is, but you need that. I think that in a lot of cases we are 10, 5, 10, 15 years sober and we feel isolated. We feel like we are not understood. We need that peer relationship. We need that unconditional love. We need that honesty. We need that partnership. The only thing you can do get well, you know, the only thing you can do alone is get sick. And I'm telling you that this program works, but a lot of us have lost the efficacy of this program. We do not feel the vitality of it. We are sitting in problems that are weighing us down. We have lost the belief in the second step, and we need to restore and get back in the game and be willing to be changed. I believe that we are each individualized expressions of God. I believe that we are down here and that God has given us an instrument to play and that no one else has that instrument and that we need all those instruments in the orchestra. And some of us have never gotten it out of the box. We don't even know we have it. It's a box sitting on the piano with a ribbon on it, and we've never taken the top off. I have been in AA 30 years. I've busted my britches to try to be a better guy. I have, you know, I think some people would say that I have grown. I'll tell you what has happened to me is you've returned me to who I am. You have removed pieces of failure from me. You have taken obstacles out of my way, and today I'm still Bob. I'm still the same man that walked in the front door of AA. I assume that if I'm blessed enough to live another 20 years in AA and get as much sobriety as Walt has over here, that I will still be Bob. That it's the process of growth, the process of enlightenment, the process of becoming more mature in the program, and recovery is a process of coming home. It's becoming who you are. There is nothing missing. You are whole and complete the way you are. You need nothing else other than what you have. When the power comes through you and you are able to, you will be able to take your gift and you will be able to have joy and peace and contentment in your life, and that I believe that we're going to find in AA what we're looking for in a bottle. That's the level it gets to. That it is, that I really believe that many of us were on a search prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what we need to really be able to stay in AA and to have our lives be full, to get the full measure, is to get the full measure of the recovery. Not just the absence of drinking, but to be able to, you know, because I think the question is when we die and we get up and someone asks us, the question is going to be, were you ever Bob? You know, that's Ellen Cassidy. Were you ever Bob? You know, and for much of my life I wanted to be someone else. You don't have to be someone else. It is, we need to find out what our gifts are, get the problems out of the way, and bad news is we have a disease that if we don't deal with it, it's going to kill us. The good news is that in order to get well, you have to learn how to live. I mean, what a gift to be forced to learn how to live and to be able to live fully. Thank you very much.